with your worldwide news update. A Syrian opposition war monitor said on Tuesday that Israel carried out a wave of heavy airstrikes across Syria as its troops advanced deeper into the country. The Israeli defense minister announced that his forces had destroyed Syria's navy. Israel acknowledged pushing into a buffer zone inside Syria following the overthrow of President Bashar al-Assad, but it remained unclear if its soldiers had gone beyond that area, which was established more than 50 years ago. Israel denied it is advancing on the Syrian capital of Damascus. Israeli officials have said they are striking military assets to prevent them from falling into the hands of extremists. The United States said Tuesday it would recognize and support a new Syrian government that renounces terrorism, destroys chemical weapon stocks, and protects the rights of minorities and women. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu took the witness stand Tuesday for the first time in his long-running trial on corruption charges. AP correspondent Tia Goldenberg reports from Tel Aviv.
Netanyahu is accused of fraud, breach of trust, and accepting bribes in three separate cases. He denies wrongdoing. In one of those cases, he's accused of accepting cigars and champagne from a billionaire Hollywood producer. In the others, he's accused of trading regulatory favors with media moguls in exchange for positive media coverage. During his testimony to a packed Tel Aviv courtroom, Netanyahu spoke at ease. He said he didn't even like champagne and that he hardly gets to finish a cigar because of his workload. A verdict in the trial isn't expected until 2026, and then Netanyahu can appeal to the Supreme Court.
AP correspondent Tia Goldenberg. This is VOA News. Pro-democracy and human rights groups say more than 100 people were killed in Sudan when 8 barrel bombs hit a market in North Darfur on Monday. Reuters correspondent Angela Johnston reports.
One activist said that while there are typically a few soldiers in the market in town, most of those present were civilians. And that some bodies were too charred or mutilated to identify. The army has frequently targeted towns in North Darfur with airstrikes as it fights the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, for control of the state capital. The army denied responsibility for the attack on the market, but insisted it had the right to target any location used by the RSF for military purposes. The conflict has been turning increasingly bloody as ceasefire efforts have stalled and crises elsewhere have dominated world attention. Both sides have targeted densely populated civilian areas in the 20-month-old war. The United Nations has said more than 30 million people are in need of aid, and some 12 million have fled their homes.
Reuters correspondent Angela Johnston. Prosecutors are suggesting various ways to keep U.S. President-elect Donald Trump's historic hush money conviction on the books. AP correspondent Norman Hall reports.
The proposals include freezing the case until Trump is out of office, or agreeing that any future sentence wouldn't include jail time. Another idea, closing the case with a notation that acknowledges his conviction, but says that he was never sentenced and that his appeal wasn't resolved because of presidential immunity. The last option is adopted from what some states do when a criminal defendant dies after being convicted, but before appeals are exhausted. Trump is pressing for the case to be thrown out. I'm Norman Hall.
The suspect in the killing of an American healthcare executive struggled with deputies and shouted while arriving for a court appearance on Tuesday, a day after he was arrested. AP correspondent Haya Benjwani reports.
The suspect in the killing of the United Healthcare CEO shooting shouted at reporters as he entered court in Pennsylvania.
We need you to do it. It's completely unjust. It's an insult. Intelligence of the American people. It's an experience.
Deputies struggled with Luigi Nicholas Mangione and pushed him inside the courthouse for a brief hearing. Mangione's defense lawyer, Thomas Diggy, told the court that he wouldn't waive extradition to New York, but instead wanted a hearing on the issue. Mangione was arrested in Pennsylvania after a McDonald's customer recognized him and notified an employee. I'm Haya Panjwani.
That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
The play for influence is underway in Syria.
Erdogan and Turkey, their stock rises while Russia's stock decreases here.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu takes the witness stand in his corruption trial.
Netanyahu denies all the charges, any wrongdoing, and he has pleaded not guilty.
And the possible implications of Trump's campaign promise to close the U.S. Department of Education.
Curriculum and what is taught in schools is completely a matter for schools, school districts, and states, not the U.S. Federal Department of Education.
Today is Wednesday, December 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Alexis Strope.
And I'm Steve Karish. So now that the Assad regime has fallen, the geopolitical dance of winning influence and securing power in Syria is beginning. The Kremlin was a key supporter of President Bashar Assad and his government's brutal attempt to defeat the rebels, and that memory may just make it difficult for Moscow to regain its foothold in Syria, which until just a few days ago appeared to be unshakable. Elizabeth Cherneff narrates this report for us from Ricardo Marquina.
The flag of the Syrian opposition was raised at the Syrian embassy in Moscow on Monday, a sign that Russia has lost a key ally in the Middle East and must now rethink its strategy and alliances in the region. Kremlin granted asylum to the ousted Syrian leader and his family in Moscow and called for an emergency meeting of the United Nations Security Council to discuss the matter. For Moscow, Assad's downfall is a serious blow. Kate Johnson is associate fellow at the Center for a New American Security in Washington.
Moscow's intervention in Syria was a way of showing it was a global power and that it had an ability to influence things outside of its immediate neighborhood. So I think in terms of the kind of geopolitical implications, it shows that Russia is less powerful than it might want to project to the rest of the world.
Moscow entered the Syrian war to support Assad in 2015, investing resources in the lives of Russian soldiers, which could now come to nothing. Analysts say it is others who stand to reap the benefits of Assad's downfall after Syria's 13-year civil war. Mark Hanna of the Institute for Global Affairs.
The big winner here is Turkey. Erdogan is thrilled, I think, that Trump has suggested he's going to remove American service members from Syria. Turkey's influence becomes more critical in that country. So Erdogan and Turkey, their stock rises while Russia's stock decreases here.
Kremlin officials say they are in contact with the new authorities, suggesting Moscow wants to reach some agreement to maintain its presence in Syria. But the role Moscow had in Assad's repression of Syria's people may be a memory difficult to erase. Neil Killiam with the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House in London.
We saw Russia bombing hospitals, bombing schools, supporting Assad drop barrel bombs on the population, supporting Assad when he used chemical weapons. So I don't think any incoming government, whatever the composition is, whether it's HTS, whether it involves the Kurds, whatever, you know, whichever groups it includes, they cannot just suddenly forget the brutality that, you know, Russia inflicted upon the civilian population.
The rapid fall of the government was for many unimaginable a month ago, destroying a power structure that some people until recently thought was here to stay and creating a new landscape that for now is unclear. For Ricardo Marquina, Elizabeth Cherneff, VOA News.
In a related story, following the ouster of Assad, a Turkish-backed Syrian militia is moving against Kurdish forces of the YPG in Syria, which the United States supports. Ankara accuses the armed group of being affiliated with militants fighting Turkey and is promising to prevent the group from exploiting a power vacuum in Syria. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
The Turkish-supported Syrian National Army, backed by Turkish airstrikes, is continuing its assault against the YPG, which Ankara claims is linked to the PKK, a group that has been fighting Turkey for decades. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, Monday, defended the assault, saying Turkey was only protecting its frontier and has no interest in Syrian territory. Analysts say Ankara sees opportunity in the ouster of the Assad regime and withdrawal of its Iranian and Russian backers. Bilgihan Alagoz is a professor of international relations at Istanbul's Marmara University.
There is no Russia, there is no Iran. Turkey was facing the Russian forces, the Iranian forces, and Assad regime forces while it is combating against PKK-YPG. If you name it as an opportunity, yes, we can name it as an opportunity for its fight against PKK-YPG.
But the YPG is supported by a small US military force that was deployed as part of the war against the Islamic State group. With the Turkish-backed Syrian National Army now approaching the Euphrates River, analysts say further advances could put Ankara on a collision course with both Washington and Syria's new rulers, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS. Aydın Selcan is a former senior Turkish diplomat who served in the region and is now a foreign policy analyst for Turkey's MediaScope news portal.
Euphrates now is like a line, but perhaps for U.S. military. If that goes on as such, that can bring Turkey indirectly head-to-head with U.S., with even perhaps HTS, and it can put Turkey in Ankara in a delicate diplomatic position again.
The Israeli military advance into Syria, analysts say, is fueling Ankara's concerns over the threat posed by the YPG and its political wing, the PYD, given the Israeli Foreign Minister Gideon Saar's speech last month declaring the Kurds a natural ally of Israel amid a growing Turkish-Israeli rivalry. Hasan Unal is a professor of international relations at Ankara's Bashkent University.
Israel is now carving out a corridor between the PKK-PYD-controlled territories and its own territories. That suggests that this is what they are trying to do, a Kurdish puppet state to the east of the Euphrates. And this is something which is likely to create lots of problems with Turkey.
Israel's presence in Syria means Ankara is likely to step up its pressure on the YPG and will be looking to the incoming Trump administration to end the U.S. military presence in Syria. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu took to the witness stand for the first time on Tuesday in his long-running corruption trial. For his part, Netanyahu claims he's being targeted for his hawkish security policies. Rachel Judah of Reuters has more.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has testified for the first time in his long-running corruption trial. He is accused of accepting gifts from millionaire friends and for allegedly seeking regulatory favors for media tycoons in return for favorable coverage. Netanyahu denies all the charges, any wrongdoing, and he has pleaded not guilty. Taking to the stand in Tel Aviv on Tuesday morning, he said he was being hounded for his hawkish security policies. Netanyahu, the leader of the right-wing Likud party, was indicted in 2019 on charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. The trial, which began in 2020, involves three criminal cases. The proceedings were interrupted by war, and Hamas fighters attacked Israel on October 7th, 2023, triggering a massive retaliatory operation in the Gaza Strip. But last Thursday, judges ruled that he must testify three times a week, forcing the longtime leader to juggle the courtroom and the war room. While on the stand, Netanyahu portrayed himself as a staunch defender of Israel's security, withstanding pressures from international powers and a hostile domestic media. Netanyahu also assailed the Israeli media for what he called its leftist stance. Meanwhile, outside the courthouse, a few dozen protesters gathered to make their voices heard. Although some were supporters, others demanded Netanyahu do more to negotiate the release of some 100 hostages still held by Hamas in Gaza. 75-year-old Netanyahu is Israel's first sitting prime minister to be charged with a crime. Under Israeli law, a prime minister accused of a crime is under no obligation to resign unless convicted. Before the war began, Netanyahu's legal troubles and political decisions, in particular his bid to curb the powers of the judiciary, bitterly divided the country. His domestic legal woes were compounded last month when the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for him and his former defense chief, Yoav Gallant, along with Hamas leader Mohammed Deif, for their alleged war crimes in the Gaza conflict.
That's Rachel Judah of Reuters reporting for us.
Meanwhile, in Ukraine, Russian forces are making advances in the east, and there was another deadly attack on Zaporizhia. VOA's Anna Chernikova updates us from Kyiv.
Russian forces reportedly crossed the Ukraine-Russia border in the Sumy region, which borders Russia's Kursk region. Tension on both sides of the border remains high. According to the Ukrainian monitor group Deep State, which regularly posts map updates with the territory under Russian occupation and Ukrainian control, Russian forces captured about 2 kilometers of the territory of the Sumy region near the village of Alexandria, and they recaptured part of the Kursk region in the area of Sudzhy. The State Border Guard Service of Ukraine did not confirm that information, but reported they did not record the Russian military's entry into the Sumy region. Ukrainian media report, referring to the sources in the Ukrainian army taking part in the Kursk operation, that Russian forces entered that area about a month ago. VOA cannot verify this information independently. Meanwhile, Russian forces conducted a missile attack on Zaporizhia. As a result of the attack, a medical institution was destroyed and nearby residential buildings damaged. At least 4 people were killed and 20 injured. The rescue operation is ongoing. Reacting to the attack, President Zelensky confirmed it was a ballistic missile attack. He said that Ukraine lacks air defense systems to protect its cities from Russian missiles. Zelensky said Ukraine is planning to schedule additional meetings with allies to discuss the possibility of Ukraine getting more air defense equipment, which is available in storage, to save more lives of Ukrainian people. In Kyiv, Zelensky announced the reboot of the training system for Ukrainian soldiers. He mentioned that the quality of training largely determines the effectiveness of the Ukrainian armed forces in battles and, of course, the preservation of personnel lives. He also announced the increase of funding for drone supply to the front line and direct funding allocated to brigades specifically. Zelensky said Ukraine is actively working on its own weapons production. He reported the start of mass production of a Ukrainian missile called Palyanitsa and successful tests of another new missile called Ruta. The first combat applications of the HEL missile drone have also been successful, and the first batch was transferred to the front lines for the use. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world.
South Korea's previous defense minister has been formally arrested over his alleged collusion with President Yoon Suk-yeol and others in imposing martial law last week. Kim Jong-hyun resigned last week and has been detained since Sunday. Kim is accused of recommending martial law to Yoon and sending troops to the National Assembly to block lawmakers from voting on it. A conviction on the charge of playing a key role in rebellion carries a maximum death sentence.
Tuesday was International Human Rights Day, and in London, human rights organizations representing Chinese dissidents in exile from Hong Kong, Inner Mongolia, Xinjiang, and Tibet held a protest outside the Chinese embassy. The organizations called for accountability for China's human rights violations and demanded that the British government confront Beijing's ongoing abuses.
Dengue fever is sweeping across the Caribbean and the Americas, with a record 12.6 million suspected cases of the mosquito-transmitted virus reported this year, nearly triple the number from last year. Health officials said on Tuesday that deaths from dengue are also rising. Cases of dengue have been surging globally as warmer weather brought on by climate change enables mosquitoes to expand their reach. The Pan American Health Organization said that more than 7,700 deaths have been reported in the Caribbean and the Americas so far in 2024. That's a more than 200% increase compared with 2023.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish, along with Alexis Strope.
Time now for our look at U.S. politics. President-elect Donald Trump has nominated New York Congresswoman Elise Stefanik to be the ambassador to the United Nations. VOA's U.N. correspondent Margaret Bashir looks at her rising career and what lies ahead.
I rise today to nominate the gentleman.
Elise Stefanik entered Congress in 2014 at age 30 as a moderate Republican representing a large, mostly rural district in northern New York State. Sally Friedman is a political science professor at the University of Albany.
She initially was not particularly a President Trump supporter, became one, moved up the ranks to party leadership in Congress, so that she is now, until she resigns, the chair of the Republican conference.
As conference chair since 2021, she is the fourth-ranking House Republican. Casey Seiler is the editor-in-chief of the Albany, New York-based Times Union newspaper.
She did not attend the Republican convention in Cleveland in 2016, and it was really only after his election and his sort of ascendancy, especially among conservatives, that she went, as she has put it, ultra MAGA.
For Stefanik, that meant defending Trump during his impeachments, his claims that the 2020 election was stolen, and being a strong campaign surrogate. Again, Casey Seiler.
She is smart. She is a very hard worker. She is rhetorically extremely effective.
Stefanik rose to prominence during congressional hearings in which she challenged the handling of pro-Palestinian protests on some university campuses. Three prominent university presidents stepped down following the hearings. Here, she questioned Harvard University's president, Claudine Gay.
So, the answer is yes, that calling for the genocide of Jews violates Harvard Code of Conduct, correct?
Again, it depends on the context.
It does not depend on the context. The answer is yes, and this is why you should resign. These are unacceptable answers across the board.
In May, she expressed staunch support for Israel in remarks before the Israeli Knesset and has received significant campaign contributions from pro-Israel lobbies and individuals. Trump announced Stefanik as one of his first cabinet picks just 5 days after the election. She will come to the United Nations with limited foreign policy experience as the world body deals with wars in Ukraine, Gaza, and Sudan, soaring global hunger, climate change, and a raft of other crises.
Richard Gowan is the UN director for the International Crisis Group.
I think that it's probable that once she becomes ambassador, Elise Stefanik is going to be focused on the Middle East. She may have to focus on Ukraine. And it seems probable, given her past statements, that she is going to be very critical towards China.
In his first term, Trump cut hundreds of millions of dollars in U.S. funding to several U.N. agencies. This time, the organization is making contingency plans for much deeper cuts. In the meantime, Elise Stefanik will find herself on a new international stage. Margaret Beshear, VOA News, the United Nations.
On the campaign trail, President-elect Donald Trump said he wanted to eliminate the U.S. Department of Education. But what exactly does the Department of Education do? And would eliminating it solve the problems that Trump is seeking to solve? I spoke with David Steiner. He's the executive director of the Johns Hopkins Institute for Education Policy and professor of education at Johns Hopkins University. I asked him just what the Department of Education does.
It spends about $80 billion a year for primary and secondary education in the United States, which, depending on how you count it, is about 8% of the total expenditure, public schools, K-12. And it runs the $1.6 trillion student loan program.
So it seems that the role of the Department of Education is really financial. It's not telling teachers what to teach, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, there's an irony in that President-elect Trump, and I'm quoting, talked about the Department of Education as, quote, indoctrinating young people with inappropriate racial, sexual, and political material. Whether that's true or not, it's not something that actually the U.S. Department of Education has any say in. Because curriculum and what is taught in schools is completely a matter for schools, school districts, and states, not the U.S. Federal Department of Education. But it's not just money. I mean, we need to come back to that. In fact, the spending of money is only a very partial part of what the U.S. Department of Education does. But what it doesn't do is control curriculum.
So along with the money, what does it do? Why is it there?
Okay. So what it does, first of all, is that it enforces the regulations that go with all of the monetary expenditures. So, for example, when it spends taxpayers' money on at what are called the title fundings, whether it's Title I, which is for low-income students, or Title IV, which is about various educational reform policies, or whether it's spending money on what's called IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. In each case, it doesn't just spend money. It regulates the way in which that money is spent.
Well, can you give us an example of how that might work in the real world?
Absolutely. So one of the things that the Office of Civil Rights and Equal Employment Opportunity at the U.S. Department of Education enforces civil rights statutes, actually five of them, to ensure equal educational opportunity for students. They protect students from discrimination based on race, color, national origin, sex, desirability, or age. And so it has a whole panoply of lawyers who can sue institutions if they transgress those regulations. So regulations have real force, and regulations are very much in the eye of the beholder. By that I mean a Republican Department of Education versus a Democrat Department of Education will issue wildly different regulations on the same statute.
So it seems like the Department of Education is quite busy and has a lot to do.
Yeah.
As a parent with kids in school, will I notice it? Will there be a difference in my child's day-to-day school if the department is gone? Will those same things continue to happen?
Well, first of all, it's very unlikely the department will go, because it would take usually 60 votes in the Senate. Secondly, even if the department were by some chance abolished, all of the things we've talked about, the spending on the titles, would have to continue unless separately Congress changed the law in each of those cases. So, for example, the funds that go to underprivileged kids under Title I would have to continue to be spent by some federal department, even if it wasn't the U.S. Department of Education. So unless Congress acts both to abolish the department and to change the law on major funding streams that go through the department, nothing would change at your local school. Right. So that's important. What might change at your local school? I said nothing. That's a little quick. What might change is the interpretation of the rights of transgender children, perhaps of LGBTQ children more generally, the ways in which civil rights are maintained, the interpretation, for example, of prayer and religious activity at your child's school might indeed change. The basic funding wouldn't change unless Congress stepped in.
So the Department of Education is one of the newer departments in the U.S.
government. Very much so. It was only created in 1980.
Exactly. So let's go back to the mid-70s, the 1960s.
Yeah.
What was different?
Just the fact that wherever there was funding going to, in various forms, schools, for example, after LBJ, that funding came from other departments. And the suggestion from a number of Republicans is that's what they would like to see. But they also say they understand that a number of the big funding streams would continue. For example, the funding on special needs children is very popular because it's independent of wealth. I mean, families of all economic backgrounds may have children who need special help. And so it's almost inconceivable that that funding would be reduced in any major way. So they acknowledge that and simply say it can come out of another department.
And we'll have to leave it there for today. David Steiner is Executive Director of the Institute for Education Policy at Johns Hopkins University. Mr. Steiner, thanks for clearing this up for us, and thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Thanks so much.
And that'll wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America.
On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform. and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Alexis Strope.
And I'm Steve Karish. Thanks for listening.